Steve, will you use your iPad? Is that...
What's the rush?
I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Business and Labor. It's a serious day, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 934A.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure places limitations on state liability for non-property claims applicable to the State Fair Council. It increases the number of members on the council, and it provides for the appointment of an additional member of the Legislative Assembly who serves as a non-voting observer and an advisor. There are no amendments. The Senate vote on this measure was 30-0.
Great. Arnie Roblin.
I'll bring my other
Senator. And, you know, bring somebody with you.
Yeah.
Just some nice people.
Other.
Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hovey and committee. My name is Senator Arnie Roblin. I represent Senate District 5 on the Oregon coast. I am also the non-voting legislative member of the Fair Council, and I was appointed to that in the inception of the bill that provided the new organization of the State Fair. With me are another Fair Board member and our new CEO, or however we want to talk about it, director, because if you have questions, I want to make sure that they had them. When we started developing the Fair Council and figuring out where we were and what we needed to do, we took over basically in January, and we're now trying to figure out how do we make this a venture that is self-supporting. It never has been in the history of the fair, just so you know, but our goal is to make it so, and what we have done is set up a plan which I believe has the potential to do that. We now can solicit from large companies and others, relationships that allow them to, you know, put banners up at the fair and do other kinds of things so we can collect and receive money for those kinds of things, which we couldn't do before. And we started to reorganize. As we were looking through the statutes that helped us get formed, we came up with a couple things that could be helpful to us, and you see them in this bill. The first one is the liability issue. We're in the process of trying to get our insurance and stuff done, and what we looked at are places like OHSU and others that have some limited liability coverage because we are state organizations, and that is what this bill talks about. The other thing we came to the conclusion of, it's helpful to have a larger board, and the reason is you invite people to be on the board because they like to be on boards, but their corporations can be those that support us in other ways of doing things. And so having a bigger group that can go out and talk to those other groups and organizations that might be willing to invest in the fair, and then making sure we get their input into what kinds of things are going to make this fair more successful to get the attendance up. And not just the fair. The bigger part, the reason that we don't end up making money, is the rest of the year. We have an exposition center that hasn't been utilized as best we can, and you're going to hear a little bit about that. We have amazing amounts of capital we need to do to fix the fair grounds and get them up. And so how do we use that fair for the other 350 days of the year to make some money instead of just spending it? How do we get the things up? How do we get conventions to come there? How do we get other expositions to go there? That's become the bigger issue than the fair itself. The fair, during the couple weeks that the fair is open, actually makes some money, and we use that to kind of get us through the rest of the year. So that's why this bill is here. It's to help give us the tools we need to be a more likely successful organization. And you can hear a little bit from my other people if you have any questions. I would be glad to answer them. As you can see from the Senate vote, it came through pretty nicely in the Senate, and we appreciated that, and we look forward to helping you in the House in any way we can.
Maybe we should get some more testimony first before we open it up for questions.
Mike Polishek, I'm the director of the Oregon State Fair Council. I think the senator covered this bill pretty well. The at the end of June, based on the Oregon revised statute, we have to leave the we can elect to stay with DAS risk management for our liability coverage, et cetera. and we are in the process of looking at various coverages, including staying with DAS. But by the end of June, we need to make a decision. When we look at doing our due diligence on the private market, one of the first questions they ask is, what is our tort liability limits? And currently, it's implied, but it's not explicit in the law that we are covered by the state's tort liability limits. And that's really probably the bigger issue of this bill. And we believe that that protects us, protects the state with respect to what our limits are. The expansion or the addition of three additional members of the council could be very helpful to us, as Senator Roblin said, with respect to attracting corporate interest, community interest. That would be very helpful as well. The challenge ahead of us, as has already been stated, the facilities have decades and millions of dollars worth of unaddressed deferred maintenance, which is not what this bill's about. However, that is really necessary in order for us to have the opportunity to succeed. And in the past, not just this fair, but fairs in general in North America have not done a very good job marketing their facilities, and we're taking a much more aggressive approach to marketing our year-round facilities for conferences, conventions, consumer shows, fairs, festivals that'll happen throughout the year. So we just appreciate your support, and I'm happy to answer any questions that I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, John Chandler here with my State Fair Council hat on, which is a different capacity than the one I normally appear in front of you. I was one of the original members, along with the seven or eight others that the Governor Kitzhaber appointed to set up under Senate Bill 7 from 2013. Personally have a long history, which I'll happily share if you're interested, but we'll keep it short this morning, with the fair, with the potential of a state fair and expo center to do the upstate, downstate, to bridge that divide, to emphasize the good things and the benefits of Oregon's agricultural and timber heritage, as well as tying in with urban areas about where jobs come from, what our state is about, the history, the future. I think it's a wonderful opportunity. The reason I volunteered, and after many years in this building, I hardly ever volunteer for anything. This is one that's a passion for me and the rest of the council. We believe this bill will help dramatically move us forward because, frankly, this is a new creature. Senate Bill 7 covered a broad bit of landscape, but we have a request in, or we will as soon as I get it drafted, to legislative council to ask them, what are we specifically? Are we are quasi-state, quasi-public. Our mission is to make this profitable, as has already been told to you. There are some bits and pieces of that, just legally speaking and a policy matter, that need some clarification. Part of that will come from LC. Part of that comes from this bill. Part of it comes from funding bills that are down in Ways and Means right now. Our intention as a council, and the reason we hired Mr. Palachik in the first place, he's one of the best in his business nationally. Tremendous resume, tremendous record of success. We're the first, I believe, state fair in the country to be making this transition from totally public to semi-public private. There are some fairs out there that are extraordinarily successful, Puyallup up in Washington, the Texas State Fair, others, that have always been either not-for-profit or private enterprises. We're being looked at by the fair industry across the country as a model. If we pull this off, it'll be a huge benefit to other fairs around the United States, which isn't necessarily the problem to the state of Oregon, but it's certainly part of our background noise. We want to make this successful, not just for that reason, but obviously because this is an iconic an institution for the state. It's 150th year of the Oregon State Fair this year. We expect you all to be there and help us celebrate that this summer, and I'll be glad to take any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think a lot of us wished you were wearing that hat. Representative Barton, question.
Thank you. I have questions. Liability, tort caps generally make me nervous, and I think warrant some scrutiny from this committee. Presumably, and I just assume this, I don't know, but in the status quo ante, when this was a purely public entity, presumably the tort cap applied. Has that ever been put to the test?
I don't know the answer to that question.
And I'm assuming since it's transitioned into this quasi-public model, if I may follow up, I'm assuming, at least I've never heard of it being put to the test. You mentioned it's implied, but that's your opinion, correct? Do we know that?
Mr. Chair, if I might, Representative Barton, I'm not sure I understand the question. Are you asking, has it been litigated and we've run up against a tort limit?
For example, yeah.
Best of my knowledge, no.
Ever? It's never. like even when it was again, a purely publicly entity?
Not that I'm aware.
To the best of our knowledge, no. But again, we look at other entities that are analogous but not identical, SAFE being one, OHSU being one. There's I'm probably missing several others that are in the same gray area. It sounds worse than I intended. This not quite fish, not quite fowl area. The same tort limitation the state has is one of those things that extends over. I think it's a legitimate. Again, I think it's implicit, personally. Again, that's just one man's opinion. Making it explicit will help because insurance companies and other lenders and who all are not usually happy with implicit statements. They want to know what their outside exposure is.
Question again, if I may follow up. How often is this a theoretical issue? How often, I mean, are there injury claims brought against the state fair?
Our claims history is very good, actually. The opportunity for claims in our business, because we are a public facility, we invite people into lots of different kinds of events, although we do everything we can to transfer risk to vendors and people who use the facilities. There's always the perception that, you know, as a quasi-state agency or a public facility, we represent, you know, a fairly deep pocket. Whether that's true or not is you know, a matter of perception. Our claims history is very good. I don't know that that it's not somewhat of a theoretical question. However, we're identified in statute as a public corporation. We're not a state agency, but the property and the structures are still owned by the state of Oregon. We lease them through an agreement with DAS, so there's some shared risk, some shared liability between the state and the State Fair Council. We just believe that this is prudent to protect our exposure.
My follow up, and I don't mean to. If other people have questions, I'm happy.
No, go for it.
What is the delta in terms of insurance quotes? To the extent you're going out to the private market, you're outside the desk insurance pool. You feel this will help you get presumably cheaper liability insurance. That's why you're doing this. They want it to be explicit. What's the difference?
Is there
actually different quotes?
I would think
there's not a big difference if, in fact, this won't really affect any claims. It shouldn't be too big of a difference if what you're saying is accurate.
We have received a preliminary quote from DAS Risk in terms of our overall package, the coverage that we enjoy now, in terms of what that would look like if we stay with them. I'm waiting for the documents to put it out to a number of private brokers. So we haven't received quotes yet from the private market. Largely because we've been cautioned by a number of underwriting experts that one of the questions they're going to ask is what are the tort limits, and we can't answer that question today at this point because it's not explicit. We believe that becomes sort of a wild card in their ability to respond to what our insurance needs are. So it's a little bit of a chicken or the egg. That's where we stand today, and we need to make that decision by the end of June.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was a little concerned about this bill at first when I see Senator Roblin bringing a bill before this committee, but with Mr. Chandler up here brought me a little bit of ease and peace, because so, we know what a straight shooter he is.
Shooter.
My question is,
we could do a bill, and I wasn't going to.
I mean, I can kind of understand there's a need for these tort limits just because, I mean, when it's fair time, you have animals and there are lots of things that are going on where things could happen or go away pretty quickly, and it'd just be nice to mitigate some of the risk across the state. Is that the reason for the tort limits?
Yes.
Representative Kammerer.
Okay, I was going to, and we're really trying to market the other uses of the fair. We may have a lot more, our hope is we'll have a lot more people on those fairgrounds over the next number of years because we have other things, boat shows, whatever it might be that come up and down. Our goal is to have lots of people coming and using those fairs and being an asset to the local community, and I think this is helpful in all those. So.
Representative Kinnemer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. what is the current estimate of the liability insurance? Just trying to understand the ballpark, how much money that is costing you.
Well, currently the preliminary quote, and I say preliminary because the numbers are still being refined a little bit, from DAS is somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $60,000 a year. We believe that it could be potentially absent this sort of limitation. We believe that it could potentially be quite a lot higher on the private market. But the only current quote, or preliminary estimate that we have from DAS is between $50,000 and $60,000 a year.
Another question.
Follow up.
What has been the trend in the attendance at the fair? I'm pretty familiar and served on the board of Clackamas County Fair, and it's done remarkably well, but is in significant contrast to most of the fairs around the state, which are declining dramatically. And I have no idea about our state fair or, more generally, state fairs nationwide, how they're faring, if you'll excuse the pun.
The recent past, this fair has declined in attendance. Its most recent experience last year under a new business model without a lot of the restrictions that have been in place in the past. We saw a pretty significant increase and anticipate, based on what we're hearing around the country, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, that events, fairs are doing very well this year, and the trend continues to be very positive going forward. So I believe that our uptrend that from last year will continue, and early indications from events that have already taken place this year is that Fairs Festival is doing extremely well. So we expect that this year will continue that, and we believe that over time we will grow significantly in terms of fair attendance, and as Senator Roblin said, in our year-round use of the facility.
Thank you. Representative Barton.
Thank you. How many employees does your organization have?
Well, currently we have three. Okay. We all of our in terms of our year-round permanent staff, for lack of a better term, one of the strategies employed by the council since its inception is that we use a lot of part-time, seasonal, temporary employees, and we do all of those currently through a TEMPA, through a personnel agency.
And to follow up, you and presumably the two other employees, do you guys receive PERS?
No.
And follow up, are you guys subject to the public contracting code or otherwise subject, for example, to DOJ? Are you required to use DOJ?
No. We have the ability, because of the Senate Bill 7 specifically excluded us or exempted us from a variety of those things. Those are the restrictions or the things that we believe made it difficult to succeed within state government. We have the opportunity, if things are to our advantage, to utilize, for example, state procurement, DAS risks, you know, those types of things, if they're to our advantage, but we're not required to. We can go on the private market. We can operate more entrepreneurially. We currently have an agreement with state procurement so that we can purchase off state contracts, but we're not required to. We have an agreement with DAS Fleet that we can use fleet vehicles and have the ability to do that, but we're not required to. Same thing with DAS Risk. We can stay within the state's insurance program, but we're not required to.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
If I might, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Barton's question, that's part of what we're going to be asking LC, is some of those kind of clarifying issues. One of the issues that has come up that really triggered that was on the Senate discussion in the earlier version of this bill. With regard to intergovernmental agreements that we were going to be entering into, and the question arose that intergovernmental agreement applies government. we are, for purposes, I think, of IGs, doing intergovernmental agreements. And like Mr. Polacek mentioned, we can take advantage of state services if they make sense to do so. Not bound, is trying to explore exactly, because this is brand new, where those lines are, which ones are fuzzy, which ones are stark. That's what we're hoping to get out, both not just with this legislation, but out of an opinion from LC, so we have a better sense of when we are acting governmentally, when we are acting privately, and how to make sure those stay in balance so we don't either, you know, violate the public trust that was given to the council by Senate Bill 7 in the first place.
May I respond to that, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, certainly.
I don't mean to be rude by this, and nor do I begrudge you guys for trying to have the cake and eat it too, so to speak. That's entirely understandable, but we have a different role, and there is a balance, I think, exactly that, in terms of that you guys are in a public and private. Are you a public entity, private agency? Admittedly, you're in this odd nether realm, and there are advantages and disadvantages to each approach, and there are costs and benefits to each approach, and I'm not aware, even at OHSU or SAFE or others, no organization quite gets it in ways that they like every single one. You're not subject to PERS, yet you also want to be subject to the tort cap limit, as an example. I think it requires some reflection from us as policymakers to think whether this is appropriate and what kind of precedent we're setting. And I mean that respectfully. I don't begrudge you for wanting it both ways.
Well, Mr. Chair, Barton, I think when Senate Bill 7 was passed by this body in 2013, some of those questions that you're raising were answered in there. Others were not. And the whole point of this exercise is simply to figure out, we're not trying to necessarily have cake and eat it too. I'd push back a little bit on that characterization. We're simply trying to find out what we can and cannot do. We are in charge of maintaining a state asset. There's a lot of land out there. There's a lot of buildings and many, many years of investment, some of which was deferred, obviously. But that's an important part, not only to the city of Salem, but of the state's portfolio. Our job is to maintain that, add to it by making a profitable operation. That's the only reason we're here talking to you folks, is trying to figure out how do we best collectively move that common enterprise forward, having made the decision to take this out of entire state ownership into this bit of uncertainty.
Yeah, and for me, it's not about cake and eat it too. It's really about preserving 150-year history of the state with regard to agriculture and understanding of how urban and rural people can come together around a state fair, which gives opportunities for students to show what they've done. It gives opportunities for people in the urban areas to come and see what farmers really do and agricultural people. It has a place in our history, and I think after having tried a number of things in the last 150 years, including moving it into parks because they had some assets, and them realizing that it was burning through a lot of their money, they couldn't get things to happen the way they wanted to, the relationships between the farm communities and those assets went really bad for a while, and it came with the change of personnel, they got it back, so we started getting people back to the fair. I believe, from being from a rural area, that having a state fair as the culminating activity for a whole lot of our groups to go to our local fairs and our county fairs, and then they move to the state fair, is a really important thing to have. And I believe it is an important thing for our state, not just for an entity like the State Fair Council is trying to preserve it, but for the state in general to have that opportunity for the kids to come back. Last week on the early morning news program, I saw an exactly just kind of the perfect example of why we need fairs. They were reporting on a 4-H project with these young people raising rabbits. And so they had this group of three rabbits that looked identical, and they said that part of the deal is you got these three rabbits from a litter and you had to raise them, and you wanted to have them all weigh exactly the same and do everything. And they were beautiful little rabbits. They looked really cute. And so then the reporter said, so after you have the competition, what are you going to do with the rabbits? And the little girl with a big smile on her face said, if I win, my rabbits are going to go to this restaurant in downtown Portland, this French restaurant, and they're going to make this into this really amazing meal. And the people just kind of looked at her, and they weren't know what to say next, you know? And she said, you know, that's what we do. We raise rabbits for food. It's really a good thing. And it was kind of like a shock, you know, to these people to understand that's what this child was raising, these beautiful little rabbits, was what she was supposed to be raising them for. And she had no qualms about it at all. Because, and those are conversations that only take place at places like the State Fair and others, when you really start having an understanding that what you get to eat tonight came from a farm at some other place. And I don't want to lose those opportunities as a state level to not have something like a state fair be successful, because it was getting to the point where people were saying we need to just do away with it. That frightens me for our state. So that's why we're here, and that's why I don't think it's kicking it to. It's how do we preserve things that really identify who the state is. We forget it at times that we are still an agricultural producing state. We send a lot of our produce to the rest of the world because it's iconically some of the best in the world. And I don't want to lose that from our urban areas not having an opportunity to mix with people at a state fair. So
yeah, and I don't think any of us, including Representative Barton, want to lose the state fair. It was just a question of, is this liability question critical to the survival of the fair?
I think those are really great questions. We don't know the answer to that right now. Yeah. What we do know is we're going to take every advantage to make it as profitable as we can so that we can reinvest all that money back into the buildings and get them back to where they need to be so that the state assets are secured and in better shape than they were before we got it. And so I agree with you.
So just for clarification, you've mentioned this discussion with legislative council. Is that clarification something that's meant as an amendment to this bill for clarification, or is this just a separate opinion on the
Mr.
definition?
Chair, completely separate. I only mention that by way of background noise for the fact that, as this bill indicates, we are in a uncharted territory here, and we're just trying to find out as best we can, and it'll take several years, I'm sure, to sort through all of that.
But it's not something you're intending?
No, sir, not at all.
Okay.
No.
Representative Kinnamer, another question?
Maybe just a comment. Hark me back to my adolescence, as I remember, the times are a-changing was a popular song. And I think what I see about this is Senate Bill 7 and this bill are part of either adjusting to the changes or dying. And I think that's where we are.
Representative Evans.
Thank you, Chair. My question is related to this, but really the mission that you just talked about, what we can do and what we can't do. One of the things I highly recommend is you, as a commission, you as a council, look at, as Representative Kinnamer said, new ways, perhaps new things to do. With the space that's there, I believe that there are emergency management resiliency opportunities for investments in structures that can provide safe harbor, potentially living space, and response capacities during times when needed, and when not needed, added capacities for making the fair more robust in terms of bringing people in and having a great time. I highly, highly recommend, now that it's no longer under the parks rubric, that as you're looking for partnerships, you're looking for capacities, there may be private and public partnerships that have never been tried before that may provide specific assets that are helpful to making the fair more viable and also making our community more secure. So please look at those as well as you're looking at all the other things.
Thank you. I had no idea we were going to spend so much time about about the fair this morning. You know, and we never did talk about increasing the size of the membership and adding a legislator. I don't pray tell why you would do that, but can you tell me the wisdom of that?
I will tell you. We had one legislator. There was a fight last session because is it a House member or a Senate member? So I deferred. I had asked my Senate president to appoint me. I deferred to Vicki Berger, who was a representative, and she lives here, and I thought that would be great. So after it was all done, my Senate president, in his typical way, appointed me anyway. And so I have been going as an unofficial member since the beginning, and Vicki went. Then Vicki left, so I became the official unofficial member. And it became clear to us that having a House and a Senate member was important as it goes forward. Just because we brought different kinds of things from different parts of the state, that can be helpful. And when we have issues like this, we could show up together and have a conversation and keep both sides informed. So we saw that as an oversight and the need to have F2 was really important. And we practiced it like we do everything in the Senate and the House for a couple of years before we actually came back to ask for a change.
Thank you. I just wanted to have a little short discussion about the membership. So really appreciate you coming forward this morning and getting us started. And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 934? Hearing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 934 and open a public hearing. On Senate Bill 488.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure requires electric hand dryers in public restrooms to operate at a noise level of not more than 84 decibels or an air velocity speed that exceeds 115 miles per hour. And there are proposed -3 amendments that increase the maximum allowed decibels to 86. The Senate vote on this measure was 24-6, and there's no revenue or fiscal impact.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Edwards. I'm a state senator from Eugene, representing Eugene and Junction City in the Oregon Senate. I respectfully bring to you for your consideration Senate Bill 488A. Before we get into the merits of the bill, I want to admit that this is not the most earth-shattering or consequential bill of this legislative session, and I thought a good deal before crafting the bill about whether or not to bring it forward at all. But come to find out, if you think that perhaps we shouldn't be dealing with matters like this in the legislature, which I considered carefully before bringing this bill forward, upon further investigation, I realized, well, if we don't want to address matters like this in this legislature, then that means we need to give rulemaking authority to some agencies to be able to just, you know, take actions like this unilaterally on their own. And having sat through a pretty vigorous debate in the Senate about energy efficiency standards and whether or not to give our state agencies that type of latitude in setting those for appliances. And it really became apparent that this legislature is just not comfortable, understandably, in turning over that type of rulemaking authority to our state agencies. So with that preface, I ask that you just hear me out. This issue came onto my radar through personal experience with my son, who's now 13 and not particularly affected or not as affected by this issue. But when he was as old as 6 years old, we'd I remember once we were at a movie theater in Eugene, and they have these really high-powered, you know, jet-powered hand dryers. And he went to dry his hands, and they're so incredibly loud, it just freaked him out. And he had a meltdown, and it took him about 15, 20 minutes to actually recover. My son has autism, by the way. I'll preface my remarks. I guess I didn't fill you in on that. Sometimes I forget that not necessarily everybody knows that. Kids on the autism spectrum, many of them experience extreme sensory sensitivities and noise, particularly really sudden, loud bursts of noises like that can really, get them all, you know, really spun up. And so it is also, so as I started doing a little bit of research on the issue and whether or not there were any regulations around this, I realized that there's really not. And so I drafted the bill. We worked with the Building Codes Division. We worked with the National Electrical Contractors Association to get it to something that was implementable for them. And essentially what this bill would do with the -A3 amendments, which I would encourage you to adopt, would say that you can no longer install a hand dryer if it is over 86 decibels in if the noise level is over 86 decibels, or the speed of the air is over 115 miles per hour. We chose those levels in looking at, you know, the most offensive hand dryers out there on the market, and then looking at their packaging and what they report, what the companies report as being either the air velocity, because some report air velocity, and or the decibel levels. So that's really how we came up with that number. And we discovered that we had missed the number by a couple of decibels in the Senate version. So we got this amendment drafted, to use very specific company names, brand names. Those hand dryers that you put your hands inside of, the Dyson ones, those are not nearly as loud as the ones that you put your hands under, like the accelerator, that blow and create an air knife. And it's not the operation of the motor that's so loud. It's the actual air, that air knife against the hands, that creates the really, really loud and jarring noise. So it's interesting. I brought this bill forward, and I've had a couple of people approach me in the halls here in the Capitol thanking me. One gentleman said he has tinnitus, you know, ringing in his ear, and it's episodic, and it's set off by every time he's around one of these hand dryers and they go off, it'll trigger tinnitus, and he'll have a ringing in his ears for 2 or 3 days before it goes away. And so in doing some research about it, we learned that this does affect, in particular, certain users of hearing aids, those with tinnitus like this individual, and certainly kids and adults with hypersensitivity caused by developmental disabilities and whatnot. So it's a very simple bill, I respectfully ask for your consideration and passage. Oh, it came off on a very bipartisan vote, and I think that speaks to, once some folks had concerns about why we're dealing with this issue in the legislature, and once they realized that the alternative is to give rulemaking authority to an agency, they said, yeah, you know, maybe this is a good thing. So
thank you, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this forward, Senator Edwards. Seriously, because I hate hand dryers, but if I had a hand dryer, I would actually probably want the loud one that's going to dry my hands faster, because when you come out and it's like, crap, no paper towels, and you have to go to one, you're 30 seconds longer in the bathroom. But my question is, how many hand dryers are we excluding out of manufacturers that are out there with this decibel level, with the change? Are we basically precluding from being sold in Oregon?
I don't know the numbers, and it's prospective, so it's impossible to know how many would have been installed had we not passed this legislation. I'm guessing that when we looked up the various models of hand dryers, I'm going to say there's 8-ish, 10-ish, a dozen, maybe somewhere between 8 and a dozen, I'm guessing, different models that have high speed. There are 2 to 4, somewhere in that range. There's only a couple of different companies that make this particular type, these particular types of dryers, that have that really loud, you know, that high-pitched, really jet-powered, you know, sound to it that are really jarring. So, as a side comment, I'm a big fan of paper towels myself. But
Representative Kinnemer.
Yes, thank you. Other states have legislation like this?
No. Interestingly, there have been a few professors that have been. I shouldn't almost say a few. There was a professor that contacted me when they heard about this legislation, and there's an association of audiologists that has done some study as well on this particular issue, and they were they were approaching it more from a worker safety standpoint. The theory in the professor's study was that, and I can't remember what the principle of physics is called, but as you increase the distance, you know, from the source of the sound, the decibel level would go down. But in fact, they found that because restroom environments tend to be hard surfaces and echo a lot, that they don't go down. And so people are exposed to the same level of noise 10 feet away as they are 2.5 feet away, which is what they determined to be the normal distance of usage. And so it's actually, you know, for restroom attendants and janitors that work in those environments all day long, they really should have hearing protection, but many probably don't.
So. Other questions?
Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, is this bill, I'm just trying to understand it, will it mandate that we go back and rip out current units, or is it just simply any new installations would fit this requirement?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, it was important to me that we're not requiring restroom, you know, somebody that operates, that has a restroom in their facility to have to go out and change out. So it's only prospective. So it would be added to the punch list. So if you're doing an electrical, if an electrical inspection is required and only if work that pertains to the hand dryer is done, say, you know, in a remodel, if you're, you know, tearing everything out and remodeling the whole bathroom, or you're building a new facility, it would be on the punch list, and it would be checked off as something that was a requirement. So no, the bill will not require removing existing hand dryers.
Senator Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, is it there's a restriction here on decibels and on velocity? So from the autistic society, is it both, or is it just the volume, the noise that bothers the children?
It's I have heard that I have heard that it can be the actual the sensory. I mean, it can be the velocity of the air against the hand can, in fact, be bothersome, but that is not, that's not the reason that we, I mean, it's really the noise is the reason that we've that I've brought the bill, and the reason we crafted it that way is because not all manufacturers report decibel level. Some and in particular the most offensive hand dryers don't report decibel levels. They only report the velocity, the air velocity. So that's why we crafted it that way.
Follow up.
Would then it be easier just to go with the decibels and say if you're going to be, I mean, that's pretty easy to get that number, you know. So if you're going to be buying a hand dryer here in Oregon, that it has to meet this decibel level, which would require them to at least list that. Rather than going with the velocity, which is a lot harder to determine.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question, and that was the route that I had originally intended on taking with the bill, and then we learned that, and we wanted to make it as easy to comply with as possible. And so we determined that the number that is self-reported by the manufacturer would be the easiest to get. So we wouldn't have to have, you know, building inspectors bringing some sort of a noise meter and testing and stuff. That's getting more complicated than people felt comfortable with, myself included. So. In going the route of really depending on self-reporting by manufacturers, we had to look at the measurements that they are self-reporting. And some report velocity, air velocity, and some report decibel levels. And so that's why we crafted it that way.
Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Barreto was actually kind of getting where I was going to go, because OSHA has recommendations, and at 92 dB, you're at 6 hours continuous runtime during the day without any hearing protection, or you can go to 90 dB for 8 hours, and then we're hitting what's already a standard and regulated and everything. So to me, I would be a little more comfortable if we went to a decibel level myself and just set it at like 90 dB, because they should be OSHA compliant on these anyhow when they're installing them, and should be thinking about these issues when they go in. So workers who would be around it, I mean, actually 92 would probably make the most sense looking at the chart and everything here. So I don't know if you're open to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, so when we looked at this, it was interesting, because some of the companies report a certain amount that they report the operating decibel level of the hand dryer, but the actual experience in the field, if you will, by people that have tested them, is that, you know, there are hand dryers that are reporting at you know, 86 or 85 or 90 or 92, that in operation are like, you know, 100 and 115, 120 decibels. I mean, they're just off the charts loud. And some of those manufacturers, you can find the decibel level, but they don't necessarily report it, and it's difficult to find. But they do, in fact, report the airspeed. And there's also a question of, you know, whether or not that decibel level is reported under normal operating conditions or the optimal operating conditions as desired by the manufacturer. So, you know, if you wave your hand under one of these dryers and then don't have your hands underneath it, it's not that loud. I mean, the actual motor isn't loud. But the air velocity is so high that air knife against the hands is what really makes them so incredibly noisy. And so when used in typical use, they're off the charts noisy. But, you know, I suppose there'd be a way to turn them on and you know, if you want your hand dryer to report at a lower decibel level, I'm sure you could devise a way of using it that's not typical for patrons of a restaurant, say, or, you know, folks using one of these. It wouldn't be typical of how they would use it, but you could certainly probably devise a way to use it that really mitigated that noise, that decibel level was lower. So, again, we went not only off of some reports that people have done on the issue, but we actually went manufacturer by manufacturer and looked at all the different hand dryer units, just being, you know, out in public and kind of keeping track of which ones really are offensive, and kind of realized that, well, there seems to be this line in miles per hour, and there seems to be this line in reported decibels by some of them. So that's how we came up with the number.
Another question. Representative Hurd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator, I have family members that struggle with what your son struggles with, so I can sympathize with and relate to what you're talking about. The only concern I have, because it's not a bad idea, I understand where you're going with it. I'm looking at some different manufacturers, and the Dyson Airblade, which is the one I think most people in here are familiar with. You stick your hand down and it hits you from both angles. It's a great dryer, but it's nearly 3.5 times the cost of the second most expensive unit out there. Now, the decibel levels, there's only one out of seven that I'm looking at here that surpassed the limit you've put in the bill. I'm not finding airspeed at the moment, and I understand you said it's when they're projecting down. Obviously, the Dyson does not do that, but I guess my concern is that, you know, we address the sound issue, but not crush the expense level of bathroom installations, because we're talking quite a bit of money here. at least what the manufacturers are claiming here is that in the last 5 or 6 years here, these units are now using, all of them across the board, about a fourth the energy of the older ones, ones you and I are still using today, I'm sure, in public restrooms, and are anywhere from a third to a half as loud. So maybe it'll start taking care of itself if we do just address the decibel rating. But I'd be interested in helping you look into further, seeing if we can nail down the decibel limit rather than addressing the airspeed. I mean, to make me more comfortable.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Representative, if all the manufacturers reported decibel levels and those decibel levels recorded or correlated to actual in-the-field experience, if you will, then I think that the decibel level would be a route that would work.
Yeah.
But that's not the case. So that's why we've approached it this way. You know, and I mean, I'm trying to make it as easy to comply as possible. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I've been, you know, it was 7 years ago. I was sitting where Representative Kenemer is sitting now in this very committee when, you know, I was first, you know, this issue first came onto my radar, and I thought, that's not a legislative issue. I really don't want to bring a bill like that, and I don't want to be dealing with this in the Oregon legislature. And then, and I thought, what I actually thought to myself is, surely these can't be legal. Are these, you know, and then I thought, I'm sure that there'll be rules out, you know, and building codes or whatever, and it'll just deal with this. And then it was only, you know, after the continued proliferation of these particular types of hand drive units that I finally said to myself this last summer, like, is anybody doing anything about this? You know, and it's not, most people, it's not an issue for most folks, you know, unless you have personal experience with it. It wouldn't necessarily be on your radar. So that's when I looked into it and I realized, our state agencies don't have the authority to make this type of unilateral action. And I guess as a legislator, I'm not comfortable necessarily giving them that type of authority either. So here we are.
Thank you. Really like to wrap this up.
One more
question. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr.
Barreto.
Yeah, I was going to say, just from a manufacturer standpoint, if you put a DBA rating on them, for a manufacturer to list that is not a big issue. So if you had a law that said any of these hand dryers that go in have to have this DBA rating, for them to comply with that is simple.
Thank you. And I'll just add that I may be one legislator that would prefer that we deal with the appliance and issues like this through the agency by rule, because these things tend to potentially change in the future. So
that doesn't surprise you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
So. If I didn't clarify, the A3 amendments are what I'm respectfully asking you to consider. So
great, we got them, and thank you very much for your testimony. Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 488? I will note, Jan, did we not receive a? Did the committee receive a letter?
The committee received a letter that is on OLIS from the company Dyson.
And if I recall, they're opposed to this legislation.
I believe that's the way I would state it, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's under the name of Jason Brown, if anyone is looking for it on OLIS.
All right. Thank you for the record. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 488. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 237.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure clarifies the authority of certain designees of the Oregon State Athletic Commission in the conduct of boxing and mixed martial arts events. There are no amendments. There's no revenue impact. There's no fiscal impact. And the Senate vote was 28-0.
Thank you. And Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andy Heider. I'm the major assigned to the Police Services Bureau of the Oregon State Police. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 237. As you're probably aware, the Oregon State Police is the regulatory body for boxing, entertainment, wrestling, and mixed martial arts in the state. The proposed bill does four things and essentially a language cleanup. Number one, it adds language to include Oregon State Athletic Commission representatives must be in attendance at mixed martial arts events, allows for a designee of the commission to act on their behalf. Three, clarifies that physicians or other medical personnel shall certify that each contestant is medically qualified to participate in the event in accordance with rules recommended by the commission and adopted by the superintendent of the state police. And it expands the event cancellation authority in regards to why an event can be canceled by the Oregon State Athletic Commission. Concludes my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Certainly seems like you may have lucked out with questions. So, Representative Widener, I guess not.
Too good to be true.
Yeah. Like it's, I mean, probably because I know people who do some MMA stuff and things like that. Now, this is professional and semi-professional is what you're dealing with here. Am I correct in saying that?
Mr. Chair.
So amateur is you don't regulate.
That's correct. To my best of my understanding, Mr. Chair and Representative, my understanding that is correct.
Other questions? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. On these events, the individuals that put them on, are they the ones that are responsible for the security? Because the last one we had in Medford turned out to be a fiasco.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, to my understanding, the promoters and the venue are responsible for the security, but I can check and make sure and get back to you on that.
Okay, because the last one we had down there, they ended up clearing the benches, I guess.
Sounds like a
good. Other questions? For my purposes, it sounds like that you could hire any number of people to provide the emergency medical at these events, including the local fire department.
Mr. Chair, there's always one physician on site during these events. The issue is really about the availability of multiple physicians to do the pre- and post-fight examinations. And so the language currently alludes to other medical providers. So we just wanted to clarify within the language to make sure that we're good to use the not a physician for all of this just based on availability so we have more options or the venue promoters have more options.
Okay, great. Thank you. Not seeing any other questions, thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 237? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 237 and open a work session on Senate Bill 237.
Chair Holby, I move Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 237 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Widener.
Mr. Chair, everything I agree with, it looks like that they have here in the bill. I will be voting yes here, but I will be checking with some people I know that actually put on some of these events and make sure there aren't any issues, so there could be a chance that I might vote no on the floor, but very, very doubtful.
Great. Matthew, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Greta?
Aye.
Representative
Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Excused.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Yes.
Representative House?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 237, having received the vote, is passed. Carrier?
Happy to.
Representative Barton, thank you. With that, I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 879.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure exempts attorneys that negotiate the terms of residential mortgage loans in the attorney's representation of a client who buys or sells a dwelling unit from the mortgage loan originator's licensure requirements. There are no amendments before you today. Senate vote was 30-0.
Thank you. John Jillians.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sean Jillians today representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We've been working with Senator Pozanski on the bill on the Senate side, and hence why you see me up here. I believe, Mr. Chair, that Senator Pozanski's office forwarded you some conceptual amendments for your consideration to sort of round out this bill. The bill is currently drafted, does absolutely nothing, and that was sort of purposeful, Mr. Chair. It was up in Senator Byers' committee on one of the last days. The original bill had some fairly sweeping changes in it, dealing not only with attorneys and how they interact in mortgage transactions with their clients, particularly with seller financing. It also exempted real estate licensees. And then it got into an issue about the nature of the collateral and how Oregon differs from the federal rules that have been adopted under Dodd-Frank and the SAFE Act. The department, which I know they're sitting in the back of the room, had some concerns with the breadth of the bill in the Senate, so we sort of went out in the hallway and agreed to just a quick amendment that would get the bill moving along in the process, and we all agreed that we would work together on some further amendments to sort of get at the issue that Senator Pozanski was most concerned about, which was the attorney provision, and I think you see that in the conceptual amendment. So the way the bill currently sits with the attorney provision, it says if you're representing a client who's buying or selling a residence, you can help them navigate the financing of it, but you can only do it under two sort of provisions. One, in the original law as it currently stands, if it's ancillary to your representation of them, which is pretty narrow definition. And then the second part says you can't be compensated by a mortgage broker or mortgage banker. No one has any issue with that. But it also says you can't be compensated by a mortgage loan originator. The way Oregon decided to go about enacting the SAFE Act, rather than exempting out seller financings from the definition of loan originator, we instead decided to say, yes, they are a loan originator, but they don't have to go get licensed. And I can see that I'm causing confusion here, but follow me just for a second, Mr. Vice Chair. So effectively what we have is individual comes in, they have a little investment property that they want to sell and carry the note. They come into the attorney and they say, hey, I'm not exactly sure how I should structure this note. Can you help me sort of navigate that? So the attorney looks at the existing statute and says, well, if you're only coming to me for this, it's not really ancillary, so I'm not sure I can sort of represent you in this regard. And then secondarily, oh, by the way, because you're doing seller financing, you're actually considered a loan originator under Oregon statute, and you're going to be paying me my fee, and so I really can't represent you without going and getting a loan originator license, bonding, all those sort of requirements. So what we're trying to get at, and I know the bar has been engaged in sort of the conversations that were brought about originally from an attorney in Eugene who's a constituent of Senator Pozanski, is how do we let attorneys represent these small seller financers so that they're sort of covered and have a little more legal advice in there. And that's what the conceptual amendment does. It expands a little more on the current language in the bill, which says, okay, if you're representing one of these folks who's buying or selling, and then we go into the actual compensated by a mortgage broker, loan originator, and say, if the person is otherwise exempt under the statute, so it's a seller financer using the three or fewer that we put in 2013, then the attorney can actually represent them and help them sort of navigate the seller financing provisions of their contract that they're going for. That's the attorney side of it. The other part of the amendment, Mr. Chair, is one that you all looked at originally on the House side in a bill introduced by Representative Kenemer, House Bill 3488, which deals with individual seller financers. Once they offer this loan to the individual, can they hold it in an LLC rather than individually holding it? The federal law is very clear under the rules that they can. Oregon's law is much more restrictive. So we were working on language to really narrow narrow that down and just say the original bill in the House side said LLCs were exempt from licensing and the requirements. This one just says if the individual is already exempt under our existing law, the three or fewer in 12-month period, the overall cap of eight, they can hold that note in an LLC for liability purposes. And it also says that any ownership in an LLC applies against the cap of eight. I think I've thoroughly confused everyone, Mr. Chair, so I'll open it up for questions and see if I can navigate through them.
Representative Barton.
Thank you. Sue, I know it makes sense to you. You spoke quite quickly this morning, and I guess I'm just slow this morning, and I just lost you along the way. And so it doesn't have to be now, but later on, can you walk me through that a little more slowly so that, because I just I didn't follow you.
Yeah.
The attorney provision. And also, in terms of the amendment, the conceptual, it was the dash 4 that was adopted. Which amendment is, and when I look at all this, which amendment should I actually look at to talk about the concept that you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, it has not, it's not in legislative format at this point from legislative counsel. I forwarded it to Senator Przanski in conjunction with his constituent last Friday. It was forwarded to the committee. It has not been submitted to LC yet. So I think that would be one that we would get back. And I was sort of just speaking conceptually. I thought it would actually be here. I apologize, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair. I would have had someone else submit it so that you could see it in front of you. But that's sort of where we're at on it.
Yeah, and I just got this conceptual amendment yesterday, yeah. So it's the first time I've
exactly.
ever seen
yeah,
it.
Yeah, with the holiday, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, it sort of got
is
caught
there anything,
up.
There's just something about the process on a procedural level that I gather it just got moved along kind of as a courtesy in the Senate. We are fairly late in the session, and we still don't – no legislative body has yet seen the amendment that we're proposing to be adopted into law. It's perhaps complex. Maybe it's quite simple, and I just – I don't know. It's just something a little unsettling about that kind of process. Is there anything time-sensitive about this for any reason? Is there any reason why this might not be able to wait until February?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, we have had that conversation because I didn't even get into the nature of collateral and how we differ so significantly from federal law that the original bill got at. I think it is, though, a sort of pressing issue that we've seen more and more. I unfortunately am on the real estate and land use listserv for the bar, and this has been a great source of consternation for attorneys in that field of whether or not they can legally go in and help folks in these transactions. So I would say that the attorney provision specifically is probably the most pressing. The other issues probably could be worked on in 16. We really would like to see the LLC issue resolved. It's something that we've been working on since 2013. We did have a different bill for that vehicle. That's a long way of saying yes and no, Mr. Vice Chair, which I
has the state bar taken a position on this?
The state bar, Mr. Chair, the state bar was working on potential language as well. They forwarded it to me through Senator Przanski. I advised them that I thought that their exclusion, both in the original bill and in their proposed language, was a bit broad, and I thought that you might have concerns with how broad it was, and I know that Mr. Tatman from DCBS had concerns originally, and so we tried to pare it back, and so we've sort of been back and forth in language, which is what you see conceptually is the most limited way I thought we could get at the issue on it.
Well, I'm certainly willing to carry it over so we can have some okay. more discussion with it, but I agree with Representative Barton. It's not quite ready for us at this point, and probably should have some discussions with DCBS and the State Bar, you know, as we – if we intend to draft an amendment, you know.
And, Mr. Chair, I have forwarded every proposed amendment to DCBS staff as we've gone along the way.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate it. And I think we'll let you off the hook with more questions until we can develop something for people to look at.
Excellent. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Was there anybody else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 879? I haven't seen any. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 879. We're going to get to Senate Bill 713 in just a second, but I do want to go ahead and open a work session on Senate Bill 574.
Mr. Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure has been before you twice before. It requires a person who's providing restoration work on residential or small commercial structures following a disaster to have the appropriate license endorsement issued by CCB. Directs the CCB, the board, to adopt rules for issuing this residential restoration contractor license endorsement in time to make it available by January 1 of 2017. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There was a minimal fiscal impact, and it came across from the Senate on a vote of 29-0.
Thank you. And committee, I know we had considerable discussion about this and questions, and after further review, I've become comfortable with that things are addressed in the bill. Representative Esquivel.
No, I was just saying it's a good bill.
Oh, I thought you had one to make it good enough for the comment.
Just put a thumb up.
Yeah. Yeah. You put your thumb up around here, you get called on. Any other questions or discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnemer.
Yeah. I just wondered, did we kind of resolve whether or not these people who are not licensed can at least remove damaged sheetrock? That seemed to have been the hub of the discussion, and at least from my perspective, was an appropriate thing. I mean, structural is a different issue, and on occasion, I understand sheetrock can be structural, perhaps, but in many, it's just...
Well, I'm not sure that anybody from the board is here today. Representative Esquivel, you want to comment
on that?
No, thank
you, Mr. Chair. I did a little bit of research on this, and the structure itself is including the part of the sheetrock is considered part, and it is in statute, so therefore we need to go by the statute. As for an individual tearing something down, they can do that, providing that it isn't a permanent situation. Whereas, example, if they have a hole in the side of their house, they can cover that with plywood or OSB, and that's fine. But they can't go along and start repairing things. So I think that's the line there. And I think it's fine the way it's written.
Yeah, and I came to the same conclusion. If you need a license to install it, you also need a license to repair it or demolish it.
Right.
And so that kind of answers the question. I think there was a little confusion between what is in building codes as a structural member and what requires a license through the CCB. So I think Representative Esquivel and I both came to the same conclusion, though we got there from different routes. So with that, is there any other discussion? I'm going to have a roll call vote, please. Matthew?
Have I made a motion?
Oh, yeah. Let's make a motion.
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 574A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
We made that first. Thank you. Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 574A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Sure.
Representative Hurd.
I'll be a no. I'm disappointed that we're going to make it a licensed situation for people to simply do, ripping down sheetrock. Not comfortable with that.
Thank you, but I'll make a comment that we're not making that a licensed issue. That's already in the statute. Hmm. We're not changing that in this bill.
But we could.
Yeah, I suppose you could. I'm not sure it would fit within this bill, quite frankly, though.
Yeah.
Other discussion? Seeing none. Matthew, can we have the roll call vote now, please?
Representative Brennan?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
No.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenner?
No.
Chair Holder?
Aye. Senate Bill 574, having received the required votes, is passed. Representative Esquivel, you want to carry that?
I'll carry it.
Thank you. Close the work session on Senate Bill 574 and open a work session on Senate Bill 140. Jan.
Yes. Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 140 extends the sunset date for the Oregon Broadband Advisory Council to January 2nd, 2020. Committee heard this on May 18th. There's no amendment. There's no revenue. There's a minimal fiscal impact. Senate vote was 30-0.
Thank you. Representative Barton, can I have a motion?
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none. Matthew, could we have a roll call vote?
Representative Bretta?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative Mescaro?
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Byrd?
Aye.
Representative Nose?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Kennedy?
Aye.
Chair Hovey?
Aye. Senate Bill 140 unreceived votes is passed, and no objections. I'll put this one on the consent calendar. That will close the work session on Senate Bill 140 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 713.
Right. Do I ask for that or do?
Mr. Chair, committee members.
Thank you.
This measure prohibits a manufacturer from requiring a motor vehicle dealer to promote, offer, or sell an extended service contract, extended maintenance plan, or similar products. Provides for the fair and reasonable compensation to the dealer when the manufacturer terminates, cancels, or fails to renew the franchise or terminates a product line. It prohibits a manufacturer from imposing a separate charge or surcharge to recover the cost of compensation to the dealer for warranty parts or services. And finally, it prohibits a manufacturer from denying the claim or charging back the claim if the dealer fails to comply with any specific claim processing procedure when the dealer submits a claim in compliance within 45 days. There's a proposed A5 amendment that makes some very simple corrections, drafting errors, and the Senate vote on this measure was 25-5.
Thank you. Could we have Mike Dewey, Chris Meyer, and Brad Tonkin? Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning. Good morning. I'll start first, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for hearing Senate Bill 713A.
And thank you for waiting.
That's the process. We understand. We've learned a lot today. Also,
was that an insult or a compliment?
Yeah.
Also,
we could all say that.
Also representing the National Hand Dryers Association.
New plan.
So on behalf of the Oregon Auto Dealers, I have with me Brad Tonkin from the Tonkin Auto Group and Chris Meyer from Herzog Meyer. And we support the bill, obviously, and with the Dash 5, which is a very technical amendment. Before I get into the gist of the legislation, I thought it might be useful to just talk about an economic impact study that the car dealers did, an independent study. The payroll in 2013 for franchise car dealers was $627 million in Oregon. That's pretty substantial. Jobs attributable to franchise car dealerships is 25,000, so it is a significant economic engine. I'm pleased to report that with regard to this measure, we have an agreement with the manufacturers on all but one aspect of the bill that we will get into, and Mr. Meyer and Mr. Tonkin will talk a bit about the legislation and what our intention is to fix something that we think needed to be fixed in the Oregon statute. Paul Cosgrove asked me to let you know he represents the Global Manufacturers Alliance. They oppose the bill with the amendment that we are bringing for you. I don't think they're going to be testifying today, but he had asked that I put that on the record. So I'm doing that just to give you transparency here. So with respect to the disagreement that we have, and we'll talk about that with the manufacturers, and I say that we have a very unique relationship with the manufacturers in that we have certain, if you will, territories. We have franchises, contracts that are fairly, fairly significant. If we want to get into that, these gentlemen could talk about that. But the most valuable asset we have is not our buildings, our people, our equipment. It is the franchise itself. So from time to time, we have angst over the agreements. And what we've done in this bill, and where we have out of four of the five aspects of the bill in terms of the amendment, we have agreement in terms of issues like if there is a wine make that is being discontinued and you have that franchise and you have all these cars, for example, mitigating how you deal with that. If there is a requirement about a service contract, we can sell other service contracts, and we can't be coerced to only provide a service contract from the manufacturer. And if we provide an invoice to the manufacturer and there's a clerical error, for example, we can resubmit it. So those are the issues where we have an agreement. Where we don't is in section 4.5A, that is the language that we are proposing and passed the Oregon Senate. Basically, what happened is in 1999, the Oregon legislature passed a bill requiring auto manufacturers to reimburse Oregon auto dealers at the same rate the dealer charges other customers for warranty work. So it's the retail rate. And in 2013, we worked with the manufacturers, and we have a methodology in terms of what is that hourly rate. And so we passed a bill so that we have in statute a methodology in terms of what is that rate going to be for each of the auto dealers. So what we have done in this bill is we have a provision that a manufacturer may not recover all or a portion of compensating a dealer for warranty parts and services by reducing the amount due a dealer or imposing a separate charge, surcharge, or other fees. So in other words, what is happening is some manufacturers for Oregon are putting a surcharge on either warranty work or when a car is delivered to Oregon. We'll have an explanation about that. And we're going to basically not allow that. This is modeled after New York. There have been litigation in terms of what we're trying to do. And recently in Connecticut, the federal district court upheld the Connecticut statute, which is similar to what we're trying to do. So basically, again, we think the manufacturers are trying to circumvent the law that passed in 1999 by putting a surcharge on either the warranty work, which is a reduction, or a surcharge on a vehicle that is delivered in Oregon, but the surcharge is not on a vehicle delivered, for example, in Washington. And as you know, it's very competitive, and we know that the average person is willing to travel about an hour from where they live to visit car dealerships. We also know that the number of visits in a car dealership is substantially less than it used to be because of the internet. So many people now buy over the internet. So we have a bill that we think is very important for the auto dealers. We think it's also very important to the public. Mr. Meyer will talk about the surcharge that is being imposed on one of his lines, and then Mr. Tonka will talk about the surcharge that is being imposed by a manufacturer. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself. And
all right, Chairman, Committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk today. My name is Chris Meyer. I'm a partner at Herzog Meyer Auto Center in Beaverton. And my portion, Mr. Tonka and I have slightly different angles on the surcharge issue. Mine has more to do with the service side. I have a manufacturer who is complying with the 1999 statute by reimbursing us at the retail rates, but then on every repair order is going in behind that. And initially, when they started this 3 years ago, it was $15 per repair order. That's since been increased to $21 per repair order, and they are backcharging every repair order $21 in order to, I'm not really sure what their reasoning is, but in order to lower their cost of the warranty work. I can go into as much depth or detail as you would like. I don't want to turn this into a hand dryer issue, but it is certainly a... I'll let you ask the question.
Yeah, very wise of you.
When we spoke to the Senate committee a few weeks ago, I probably was a little bit deeper than I am starting out today, but I'm happy to answer questions. But suffice it to say that a warranty repair that's being reimbursed at retail, again, just in summary, is being backcharged $21 as a means to circumvent the statute passed in 1999. Incidentally, as one little anecdotal side note, one of the things the manufacturers asked us to do on our financial statement in regards to that $21 is to split that fee three ways between our service department, our sales department, our parts department. And I could never really understand why they want us to do that. And the only thing I can figure out is that they are trying to make the impact appear to be less when we review a financial statement every month, so that we don't see the, you know, how much that's actually costing us. But it is substantial, and it is an end run around the legislation that's already in place.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and the House of and Representatives. I want to thank you for your time. My name is Brad Tonkin, Ron Tonkin Family of Dealerships. We employ just about 1,000 people in Oregon, a little more than 1,000 people in Oregon, several hundred in the departments of parts and service. To follow up what Mr. Meyer has discussed, I'll give you another glimpse into what one of the manufacturers that we deal with has instituted as well, and I kind of chuckle a little bit because the idea that there's compliance on one end and then there's this odd charge on the other end it's difficult sometimes, and you have to grin and bear it. The thing is that it's a precarious situation because the franchise is the most important and the most valuable piece of the whole puzzle, if you will, for an automobile dealer. So to be here testifying in a bill that they're not in favor of and they're against, you have to be careful because you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you because they're our supplier. So it's a touchy situation. As it was stated, the warranty bill passed in 1999. And what that bill basically said is that the service department, all we have to sell is our time in the service department, and we have space to work on cars. And the manufacturer is saying, hey, when we produce a vehicle for you and the customer buys it, if it breaks, then you guys are our agent to fix it. And so we rely on you to fix it, but we're not going to pay you what every other customer in your service department pays. Now, that doesn't just rub the dealer, but it also impacts the payroll and the repair that a technician receives. It also impacts the parts department personnel as well, because those repair orders don't generate the same income to the dealership nor to those people in the dealership. So that has an impact. So logically, technicians and parts people, they service customer cars, but it's their least favorite service because it doesn't pay as much, which is understandable. So we got legislation passed in 1999. It said the manufacturer has to comply and they have to pay exactly what a customer would pay. Fine, that was done, and then the manufacturers came up with a formula, and we worked with them and came up with a formula. It was very difficult to get a manufacturer to buy into what our rate was. We finally have done that. And we finally got to a point where the manufacturers now are paying the dealers the retail rate, which is terrific. Then along comes one manufacturer, and they say, okay, well, we're going to pay it. We're going to pay it to you. But you know what? We're going to increase the invoice price of the car we ship you in Oregon, only in Oregon, in order to offset what we're paying you for the warranty repairs. And we said, now, hang on a minute. This goes against the entire vehicle distribution system. As a matter of fact, many years ago, when a vehicle was produced in Lansing, Michigan, the federal government said, hey, we've got to equalize freight, because if someone takes delivery in Portland or in New York and someone takes delivery in Lansing, Michigan, where the car's produced, they really all should pay the same. They should pay the same amount for the car. So they equalize freight, so everybody pays the same amount. The same is true with the invoice of a car. Whether you're the smallest dealer for that, let's take Nissan, for example. If you're the smallest Nissan dealer in the United States or the largest volume Nissan dealer, or Ford or Chevrolet, you name it, every dealer pays the same amount for a car. The invoice to that dealer, no matter how many they sell, is exactly the same. Because that's the way the franchise system works, because it's to create equilibrium. Well, all of a sudden, in this case, one of the manufacturers said, look, we're going to pay you the retail rate for the warranty repair, but we're going to increase the price of your car. That's a very dangerous precedent, because all of a sudden, Oregon dealers who are doing business in a state that is bordered by Washington, Idaho, and Northern California now have a competitive disadvantage in selling their product, so that actually, in this case, somebody can go across the border. They don't have to pay sales tax if they buy in Washington or Idaho or Northern California, because they bring it back to Oregon. They only pay the DMV charge in Oregon. They can actually go across the border and purchase a car and bring it back here, and it's possible it could cost less, or a dealer could lose the business here, which impacts the revenue here to the state. So that's really what we're dealing with in a nutshell. And what we're saying is, hey, let's not have one issue, the warranty issue, offset this other issue and allow manufacturers to arbitrarily increase the price of vehicles here in Oregon or in any other state for that matter.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Doherty.
Okay. So basically, the first question I'm going to have is, do you have hand dryers in your dealership? Okay,
great. We do. Yes, we do. We have Dysons, by the way.
Thank you. So basically what they've done is that you guys said that you didn't want to pay the warranty price that they unilaterally kind of gave you, and so they added it on to the price of your car?
Yes.
Is there really any difference between the two techniques that they're...
Well, that's hard to say, because if the manufacturer produces a lousy car and the warranty claims start rolling in, then they're going to turn around and say, well, we've got to increase the surcharge to you.
Okay. And so basically you're paying the warranty.
We're paying. It's important. This is an important distinction, because I don't want to we don't want to leave the impression that the manufacturer isn't paying for the repair. But they're paying, if you will, a wholesale rate for the repair as opposed to the market rate.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification.
If I may, Mr. Chair, so with this bill, you realize that we have other portions of the bill we kind of glossed over a little bit that we have an agreement on. And to be fair, the manufacturers did offer an amendment in the Senate to extinguish or take out the language, new language in Section 4 or 5A. And that they offered that. There was a motion that failed, and the bill comes to you with the language that we support. But otherwise, we have an agreement on the bill. And we decided to move forward. We looked at other language, but we felt this was very, very fair in terms of how the process was working. And we kind of wanted to kind of nip this in the bud. Mr. Tonkin is right, though. We have to be very careful, because this is sometimes a love-hate relationship, but we have to work. We strive to get consensus on every piece of legislation. And we've had a number of phone calls over the summer and through the fall prior to getting here. We just couldn't get an agreement on this one area.
Welcome to my world. So is Oregon the only state that passed this 1999 law?
Mr. Chair, no. There are other states that have this particular provision perhaps written a little bit differently. And then what other states have done based on where the manufacturer has gone on the surcharge and on the warranty work or a new car coming into the state. We took this language basically from New York, because this was happening in New York. So
thank you.
Other states have both of these.
And one other thing I just want to – one other point I want to make. Many manufacturers have just paid the retail rate, and that's been it. There's only one manufacturer that I'm familiar with that has increased the price of their cars, but it sets a precedent if we allow it. And then, of course, what's happened on...
different manufacturer.
Yeah, with your, and your end.
Yeah, our two manufacturers, the issue he has with one manufacturer is my warranty reimbursement issues with a different manufacturer. So it's one of those insidious things that you give them an inch, they take a mile, and they've found a crack in the reimbursement policy, and that's what we're trying to sew up.
Thanks, Representative Evans.
I just, very briefly, I appreciate this bill. We had a similar, or at least in my mind, a similar bill having to do with farm equipment and franchises, and I'm looking forward to hopefully having a chance to vote in favor of this, because I think the jobs that you are doing right now are important, and the manufacturers, I'm sure Oregon is not at the top of their list for concern, so I'm glad that you brought this forward. Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to Chair Hovey's question, Oregon has this, Washington, Idaho, California, are they, do they pay retail? Or do they, are they charged retail?
I am not sure of all of the states, but it's certainly I think the most of the states are.
Okay.
But I cannot speak specifically about those.
And I might add, this is a contract between the two entities, their franchise. And a dealer can agree, if they choose, to pay a different rate in their contract. But at least they have this option, which started in 99, to bill the retail rate. Now we have a methodology that everybody agrees on.
Thank you. Representative Barreto, follow-up.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm a manufacturer too, and I understand this relationship between dealers and manufacturers, and sometimes it is a little tense. But in this bill is the requirement for you to contract or use their long-term contract as far as a warranty contract. Is that,
Mr. Chair, Representative Barreto? If it is to their advantage, we are actually fixing that so you're not coerced to an extended service contract. You can, if the market is better somewhere else, you can go somewhere else. So you can't be coerced as a matter of that they would potentially void your contract if you didn't use their agreements.
Okay.
Other questions? Not seeing any gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony this morning.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate it. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on Senate Bill 713? Not seeing any, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 713A and open a work session on Senate Bill 713A. And we have a -5 amendment to adopt.
Chair Hovey, I move the -5 amendment to Senate Bill 713A.
I'll just clarify, that's the A5.
Representative Barton moves the A5 amendment to Senate Bill 713A. Discussion on the amendment. Is there any objection to adopting the amendment? Seeing none, the A5 amendment is adopted.
Chair Hovey, I move Senate Bill 713A as amended to the floor that do pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves Senate Bill 713A as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Widener.
As someone who's been involved in a lot of these deals and stuff, I'm very supportive of what the dealers are doing here, because I know how much leverage a manufacturer has over you on certain issues, and I've been on both sides of this, and this is a very good bill, and I support it.
Representative Barreto.
Mr. Chair, yeah, I'm going to give this a courtesy vote, but reserve the option of voting the other way.
Thank you. Other discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, could we have a roll call, please?
Representative Barreto.
Aye.
Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Representative Esquivel.
Excused.
Evans?
Yes.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Byrd?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Penner?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. Senate Bill 713A, having received the votes, is passed to the floor. And Representative Fagan, you've been way too quiet down there. Would you like to carry this bill?
I've been dying to carry this bill. That's why I was quiet all day in the hopes.
So this is the reward. I wondered how that
works. I used to sell cars. So that's why I was having to carry it.
With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 713A. And I take a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Evans to vote on which bill was it?
237.
Chair Holby, I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of allowing Representative Evans to vote on Senate Bill 237.
Representative Bart moves to suspend the rules to allow Representative Evans to vote on Senate Bill 237. Is there any objection? Seeing none, the rules are suspended. And Representative Evans, how do you vote on Senate Bill 237?
Yes.
Representative Evans votes yes on Senate Bill 237. With that,
whatever
I will,
you do.
Carry over. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 237, and
thank you, Mark.
We will be carry over.
Sorry, I was trying to understand this.
Senate Bill 488A.
And I was using an analogy with
we will carry over
and doctors and OHP,
Senate Bill
879A,
and we will carry over Senate Bill
934A. Right.
And I believe that is it.
And so it's the same thing.
With that, I will. We are not meeting on Friday.
Oh.
But if our conversations go any longer than as long as they did today, we may be meeting all the rest of the times we have available. So with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor. House Committee on Business and Labor.
Very true.
We adjourn.